chance, I guess. Our heroes die, but we can still find happiness.
Good morning. Happy, possibly in quotes, Monday. I'm Sarah Ledoux, hosting this morning for Joe Donahue. Joined today for the roundtable panel by Senior Fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Political consultant and lobbyist taking her seat, Libby. Hello, Libby.
Hello, Sarah.
Nice to see you.
Good to see you too.
Preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson. Good morning, Terry. How are you?
Good morning, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
And we have a new member, a premier debut panelist joining us this morning, biomedical engineer and principal scientist at Regeneron, Ahmed Abu Hakma. Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Sarah, and thanks for the invitation.
We need to do a little get to know you before we start discussing the news of the day. How do you, where do you hail from? What's your deal? What should people know about you?
I wasn't expecting the question, but of course.
Oh, I should have emailed you. Hey, get ready for me to ask you what your deal is.
Yeah. Well, first of all, again, thank you.
Of course.
My name is Ahmed Abu Hakma. Born and raised in New Jersey, came up to the Capital Region in 2012 for graduate school, where I've stayed for work there since. Parents are originally from Palestine. Studied biomedical engineering, involved in the local Muslim community, love to play sports, happy to be here.
Thanks for coming in. We will begin our conversation this morning by talking about the trade deal that was reached yesterday, and further news will come out about it as the week proceeds. But what we have now this morning, President Trump announced yesterday that a trade deal with the European Union was struck after talks with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen in Scotland. Under the agreement, most EU exports to the U.S. will face 15% tariffs, which is down from the 30% tariff that was recently threatened. President Trump says the EU agreed to accept imports from the U.S. without tariffs. Trump says that the European Union has agreed to purchase $750 billion of American energy, which Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the EU's executive branch, told reporters would be spread out over 3 years. President Trump is hosting Prime Minister Keir Starmer of Britain at his two golf courses in Scotland today for day-long talks that were expected to cover the humanitarian crisis in Gaza and the grinding war in Ukraine. They were also expected to further discuss tariffs. A trade deal has been met. What do we think about this? Jim, we'll begin with you.
Well, as with all of these deals and the Trump administration, the devil is in the details. And as we can see from the Japan deal that was announced just a few days ago, what was initially boasted about, turns out not to be quite so clearly the case. And as the details come out, it's taking credit for a lot of things that already exist. And it's missing the context that I think is important. So on this one, as you said, Sarah, at the opening, the 15% that's agreed to is down from the 30% that was threatened. Okay. But it's up from the 1.2% that has existed previously. So this is one of those situations where Donald Trump has created a threat, created chaos. The threat is on, the threat is off. It's 2 weeks, it's 30 days, and who knows what. And then suddenly there's an announcement that it's a great deal and he has saved the day by reducing it to 15%. Steel and aluminum, or as the Europeans would say aluminium.
Mm-hmm. At least the Brits, yeah.
Yes, is at 50% still. What's really unclear, and this might be important to many of our listeners, is what's going to happen with wine and spirits. Where do they fall in this? What is clear is that not all of the European leaders are happy about this. And I think it calls into question for me, what is the American end game? I mean, clearly Donald Trump thinks transactionally, and he thinks in terms of you either win or you lose. And if there's a trade deficit, we're losing. And so there's been over a $200 billion trade deficit, with the European Union, and therefore he thinks we are losing. This is a zero-sum view of international trade that really no economist, and I wish Aaron Pasitti were here with us to give the real details on this, but no economist really agrees to. Even a conservative economist don't agree that that's how international trade works. Yet Trump is absolutely determined to think about it this way, and I think it plays well for him politically. What is never said is that the U.S. has a $100 billion surplus in services, in intellectual property, in tourism, in finance, in consulting, in higher education. So what if the Europeans decided, well, we need to retaliate against the Americans because they have a surplus? What the way it really works is that, you know, you have a surplus here, you have a deficit here, and in the end, a rising tide is supposed to lift all boats. Now, if somebody is violating the norms of international trade, there's ways of dealing with it. But threatening tariffs, creating a crisis, saying it's going to be 30%, and now it's a victory because it's down to 15%, this is really problematic. I would just say there's a couple of other things about this, too, that bear watching as the details do come out. One is this creates, or it exacerbates, problems that already exist between Northern Ireland and Ireland. Brexit created this problem already because Northern Ireland is part of the UK. Ireland is its own country. And so now Northern Ireland will have a 10% tariff because they're part of the UK, and that's the deal that the UK has with the US. Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, will have a 15% tariff. The Good Friday Agreement was already under lots of pressure after Brexit. This increases that pressure. And what happens in Ireland always matters in the U.S. There's lots of Irish Americans here, me included, and people pay attention to it. Those politics matter also. It certainly matters within the U.K. It matters within the EU. So that's one thing. And, you know, the Germans and some of the German industry are upset about it. Certainly the French are concerned in many ways. So creating chaos within the EU, is this necessarily good for the United States? Destabilizing the European Union, is this good for the United States? I would say it is not. We want Europe to be stable. We want Europe not to go back to the first half of the 20th century when they had two world wars. We've seen a long run of relative peace and stability. Why upend that?
Ahmad, are you ready to jump in? You have comments?
Sure. Yeah, no, I think it's really important that Jim pointed out that, yes, the deficit might look like it's 200-some billion dollars, but if we look at the services that we offer, many economists actually view that as 100. But when I was seeing these numbers, I always asked myself, so what? You know, the United States and Europe, there may be similarities in styles of life, but there's also differences in styles of life. So if I was over there last October for a work trip, and the attitude towards work is very different. They don't work 40-hour weeks, many of them, like we do. And so their take-home pay based off of purchasing power, and when you normalize all that, is less. And, you know, according to an article in the Journal of Economic Dynamics and Control, they make between, the U.S. works about 7 to 26% more than Europeans. And Europeans have different spending habits than us. You know, they have 19 to 54% less spending on work goods, on market goods, and 21 to 47% less spending on home inputs. And so I ask myself again, so what if that deficit exists? You know, the United States also, we have to remind ourselves that we are a relatively new nation compared to those countries. And we are importing a lot of goods that are authentic there that we try to replicate here. You know, we can make our own mozzarella cheese, but we like our mozzarella cheese from Italy. And yeah. And Italy's not going to ask for our mozzarella cheese.
No.
They're not going to ask for our olive oil. They have darn good olive oil there.
There's a mozzarella deficit for a good reason.
You know, exactly. So these are some things we want. You know, when it comes to the car industry, which Trump liked to talk about, yeah, we like to make our pickup trucks, but you try driving those gas-guzzling pickup trucks on a narrow European street. It's just not going to fly. And so for a man that likes to prop himself up and appear strong, I think this will be tacked down as a win in some people's books, but it's a win based not based off of merit. It's a win based off of bullying, you know, and that I think is very problematic and shows the loss of some of our luster in the global trade market. And it just reminds me of the genesis of this country, where Britain could bully us and raise tax on us whenever they wanted to. And that led to the Boston Massacre and the American Revolution. And I just ask myself and you, have we lived long enough to become the villain? And I'll stop there.
Libby?
Well, some people have lived long enough to be the villain. And in this particular time, it's Donald Trump. He has what people call hero or savior syndrome. Creates a problem and then swoops in and says he solved it. This was the first 4 years of his administration. It's going to be the next 4 years of our lives. You know, everybody can debate the this, the that, the percentages, all of that. But what we really need to recognize is that we have a man in the White House who is in constant need of positive reinforcement from wherever it comes. And seeing himself as a savior, he sees himself as the savior of white Americans from the scourge of illegal immigration and the scourge of people of color and all of that. And we see what he's doing to try to solve that problem. And he created a problem, and now he's going to try and solve it. This is a man who, regardless of what's happening, will always create a problem so that he can solve it, because he can't get any further than his own creations. He can't see the validity of what other people do, right? He can't. He just can't. Look at he and Elon. That's a perfect example. You know, Elon got a little too close to the press, got more press than he did in a week, and then Elon was gone. So this is what we're dealing with. And, you know, the trade wars will continue. I think that, you know, the next president won't be Donald Trump, and things will go back to sort of stasis. Things will get renegotiated and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, he's about saying the United States has been screwed by every single country in the world, and I'm going to fix it.
Terry Gibson.
Well, what I'm following is how all of this plays out in the media, especially the legacy media. And what's disappointing to me is how often the legacy media really just parrots Trump's talking points, really provides him with that positive reinforcement that he's seeking, and assists him in what I think right now is winning a public relations campaign because of how they message what he is doing as something positive, as something to celebrate. The headlines today should say, the headlines across all media today should say that Trump announces a 15% sales tax on consumers, on U.S. consumers. That's what it ought to say, because that's what it is. And that's what it ought to say every time he decides to dabble in this tariff issue, whether it's 5% or 1% or 20% or 30%, it's ultimately a tax on U.S. consumers. And all too often, the media, the legacy media especially, has not really clarified that and make it sound like something to celebrate. And all you got to do is walk down the aisles of any supermarket or Walmart, and you can see that since this tariff strategy has been imposed, things are going up. And Donald Trump promised that the cost of things would go down. And the actual opposite of that is happening. And I don't know how long we have to wait before U.S. consumers notice it. Surely they notice it now. But how long we have to wait before they rebel against it, which is really what it's going to take to hold Donald Trump and the entire Republican Party and Congress accountable for this. Things are not getting better. They may be getting better for Donald Trump in the short term. I think it's also creating what is most likely a pay-to-play situation behind the scenes, where the large corporations, the large manufacturing corporations that can afford it, are finding ways to essentially buy an exemption from the Trump administration, from Donald Trump, whether that's funneling money directly to Trump somehow or funneling it to a lobbying group or an election, re-election group. There's multiple ways to do that. And I think it's also creating that in other countries where organizations, corporations, political leaders in other countries are finding ways to engage in pay-to-play to buy favor with the Trump administration. That has to be happening behind the scenes as well. So for Trump, I think this is all working out really well. But for the American people, I don't see any sign that any of these strategies related to the economy are doing anything to help reduce our cost, our cost of living, and I don't see any sign that it will in the future.
Jim Ketterer.
Yeah, I just wanted to add some details to what Terry said that's so important, that, you know, a tariff is a tax on consumers. And so I think it's useful to look specifically at what do Europeans send here that are now going to become 15% more expensive. One of them is pharmaceuticals. Well, there's been a long-standing effort to get down the cost of drug prices in the U.S., so this clearly doesn't happen. This doesn't help that effort. Second is car parts. And so these parts are brought in. It's not because it's just, you know, a high-end Mercedes or something. These are car parts that are part of the cars that Americans buy. Cars are already incredibly expensive right now in the American economy. So those car parts are going to be 15% more. And it's not so easy to say, like, well, we'll just make them here. They are part of the cars that are assembled here for a good reason. And it's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be cheap to change that. And then industrial chemicals as well. And so that goes into lots of other things that are going to be part and parcel of what Americans have to buy, and that cost will be passed on to the American consumer.
And I'm a little concerned about the pharmaceuticals, to be quite honest with you, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm on Medicare now. It's a wonderful thing, but there are still drugs that I have to pay a lot more for than I'm on. And I'm afraid that the real deals that Biden was able to cut with the pharmaceutical companies may just very well go away. And so people like me who are taking certain drugs so that I don't stroke out,
yeah,
basically,
sure.
Right? That's what they're for. You know, I could see...
Beautifully put.
Yes. Thank you very much. I could see having to pay much, much, much more for those drugs based on the tariffs and based on... Whose hand is in whose pocket when it comes to negotiating insurance rates on the federal level and the pharmaceutical companies? And yes, I know they do research, but nonetheless, they're raking it in.
Amit?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, one thing that also crossed my mind when I was looking at the details of how the EU agreed to purchase U.S. oil instead of Russian oil is potential environmental impact. You know, if oil is going from A to B, on land, a lot of times that's going through pipelines. And spills can happen in pipelines, but they can typically be much more contained. Spills don't happen all the time, but if the U.S. is sending it, it's going in a marine vessel. And the potential environmental impact for that would be catastrophic if there would be any spills. And so there is a higher probability of that, which is something that is not lost on me.
We will return to this topic after a news break from BBC. The panel this morning, Ahmad Abu-Hakma, Jim Ketterer, Libby Post, and Terry Gibson. And we will be back after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke. The music this morning is by Rainbow Girls. The trio is playing Cafe Lena in Saratoga Springs tomorrow night, and the playlist is posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. You can join our conversation this morning by emailing us panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. In studio this morning, biomedical engineer and principal scientist at Regeneron, Ahmad Abu-Hakma, senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, political consultant and lobbyist, Libby Post, and via phone this morning, preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson. We are discussing the trade deal reached yesterday. Did anybody have further comment or question?
Go ahead,
Jim.
To add one kind of overview.
You're next, Terry.
Comment is...
okay.
Thank you.
Why would the Europeans agree to this? You know, it just doesn't sound, even on the press release version of this, it doesn't sound like a good deal for the Europeans. And it seems to me that the Europeans, because the EU has a great overlap with NATO, that they want to keep the Trump administration and the Americans in general engaged, and not only don't want a trade war, also have an actual war going on with Ukraine and Russia, and that continues. It's kind of fallen out of the headlines, but things are not going well. I think that's on the agenda for Trump and Sturmer to talk about today.
Mm-hmm.
And So I feel like there's other strategic reasons that the European Union has decided to do this, even though it's causing lots of pushback from the members.
Terry Gibson?
Yeah, I do think that makes sense. I think there's a certain need for stability of some sort right now as they deal with much bigger issues. So I don't think we've seen the last of this. I think the tariff issue is going to continue to shift both in Europe and other places around the world. But what I wanted to just point out and remind everyone is that part of this tariff strategy was supposed to help incentivize and increase manufacturing here in the country to try to replace the manufacturing that we've lost to other countries. And if you talk to manufacturers, especially small manufacturers or mid-sized manufacturers that had, at least until the tariffs started, been doing pretty well here in this country and doing a pretty good job of rebuilding manufacturing, they will all tell you that even though they're able to manufacture most of what they build here, they still rely on importing various parts and pieces for what they need to build wherever they're building from other countries. And the reason for that is that the startup cost of buying new equipment, new tools, and new training to be able to fully manufacture every single component that you need for whatever gadget that you're making is really not affordable in the short term for most of these small to mid-sized manufacturing companies. And so when these tariffs hit, they do real damage to the manufacturing that we already have here, with maybe the exception of the very large manufacturers that are established, but even they will tell you that there's pain there as well. So not only are we seeing the cost of living continue to rise, which Trump said that he wouldn't do, we are not seeing any real gains in establishing new manufacturing, as Trump said he would do, and that's really in part to the way these tariffs affect those who want to manufacture in the United States.
Anybody follow up? All right. We will continue to follow, of course, the story of President Trump's visit to Europe. He's meeting with the leader of England or Great Britain today. So we'll figure out later as the reporting comes through what they have talked about and discuss that later in the week. Let us now turn our attention to the latest from Gaza. This from the AP. On Sunday, the Israeli military began limited pauses in fighting in three populated areas of Gaza for 10 hours a day. Part of measures, including airdrops, as concerns grow over surging hunger and as Israel faces criticism for its conduct in the 21-month war. The military said the tactical pause from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. their time, of course, would increase humanitarian aid entering the territory. United Nations Humanitarian Chief Tom Fletcher welcomed Israel's decision to support a one-week scale-up of aid and said some movement restrictions appear to have been eased, but he said the action needs to be sustained, fast, and fast. Images of emaciated children have fanned criticism of Israel, including by allies who call for the war's end. Israel has restricted aid to Gaza's population of over 2 million because it says Hamas siphons it off to bolster its rule. Israel's not provided evidence of that claim. Much of the population, squeezed into even smaller patches of land, now relies on aid. And as the military had warned, combat operations do continue otherwise. Health officials in Gaza said Israeli strikes killed at least 41 Palestinians from late Saturday into Sunday, including 26 seeking aid. Ahmad, would you like to begin?
Sure. Very difficult to discuss, of course, being Palestinian myself, but actually just being a human, anyone here, I'm sure this would be difficult to discuss. When I hear that more aid is being let in, forgive me for being cynical as I discuss this. More aid being let in for what? To provide more sites for Palestinians to be bombed at when they're picking up food? Because that's what's been happening. More aid for what? So that they have food to watch themselves be murdered later that evening after 8 p.m.? You see, when a monster tells you they're going to do monstrous things, we should believe them. At the beginning of this, we were told that no food and water were going to be let into Gaza. Did we need to see the pictures that we saw of those emaciated children? Did we need to see mothers with trembling hands because they themselves are malnourished, feeding their children who are 2 years old but the same weight of a newborn child? Did we need to see that? So just to begin and open this conversation, I'll let others speak, and then we'll go back and forth. When a Palestinian has acts of genocide being committed against them. And this is not a clumsy term to use. It's been used by Israeli scholars, and it's been used by anyone who has a conscience and understands the legal definition of genocide. When acts of genocide are being perpetrated against the people in a concentration camp, because that is what Gaza can be described as, it is not sufficient to let food in, because they're still being murdered in other ways. And it is not sufficient to let food in and stop killing them, because it's still a prison. The right act is to end the blockade, to end the occupation, to dismantle the concentration camp, to liberate the people, and to take the people who are oppressing them to task. And I'll stop there.
Jim?
Yeah, well, so, Sarah, you said in your intro you were talking about Tom Fletcher. He's with the UN. He oversees the OCHA, the Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. This is the organization that has the experience, has the wherewithal, has the infrastructure to be delivering aid in a way that is not only effective, but also avoid some of the things that Ahmed was talking about, that it is not politicized, militarized, and part and parcel of a broader military strategy, which is what the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation that has been set up by the Israeli military and supported by the U.S., that's what they have been doing. So let the U.N. do what they do, know how to do, and do it well. That's one thing. Another thing that I would add is that there was a story last week that got a little, but not, I think, not enough attention. The headline was said, there is no evidence that Hamas, and I have no support for Hamas, and many people in Palestine also do not, but that Hamas, there's no evidence that they have been stealing and or manipulating the aid. Now, what was particularly interesting about this story is that who was the source for it? The Israeli military. And so that says to me that some of the Israeli military, I suspect the kind of, you know, longstanding professional military people, are splitting off from the government. They are disagreeing with the government. And you saw these kinds of splits after Israel invaded Lebanon and then stayed there for quite a while, and you started to see these kinds of splits both within the military and societally. Another split that you see in the cabinet is with the two most right-wing members, Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, the national security minister and the finance minister, and they were left out of the call about restarting aid. They, you know, these are very prominent politicians. These are very high positions in within the cabinet, and they weren't included in the call. And so Ben-Gvir, for instance, has been very clear. He has said it out loud again and again and again that his idea of what should be going on is that there should be no aid going into Gaza, that Gazans should be, quote-unquote, encouraged to leave, and that the territory should be reoccupied and resettled. That apparently now is not only not in line with what some of these with many other Israelis are saying, but is not even part of the most recent conversations among the cabinet of the government. So you're seeing interesting and important things happening within Israeli politics. So I'll just leave it at that. But I think that just kind of adds to what Ahmed was talking about as well. Kind of on the Israeli side, there's more going on than meets the eye.
We will take an underwriting break and return to this topic right after that. You are listening to the Roundtable Panel. You can email us, panel@wamc.org, and we'll return after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and for Joe Donahue for a few days this week, here with Ahmad Abu-Hakma, Jim Ketterer, Libby Post, and Terry Gibson. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. We are discussing the latest on the war in Gaza, between Israel and Gaza, and the ceasefires that have been announced. Terry Gibson.
Well, you know, it's clear that the far-right extreme faction of the government in Israel is really calling all the shots, seems to have all the power, and at least seems to have had full support from the United States government, at least from the Trump administration. And that, of course, for me, is disappointing. I've continued to be disappointed how our government has not pushed back on this extreme faction of the Israeli government. But it's not surprising, really, I guess, since our government is being controlled by also an extreme faction, one that has tied itself almost to an absurd extent to Christianity, and for a party that claims to be the party of love and compassion, they certainly have a strange way of showing it when it comes to helping children live, be fed, and helping mothers take care of their families. And I just can't help but believe that we are really right now participating openly and even funding openly our government much of the pain and suffering that is being inflicted on these people. And it's past time for our government to step forward and try to take a lead in solving the problem. But our current administration has continued to show that they're really not capable of solving really any problems. And so I think that it's going to probably fall to leaders in Europe and other leaders in other Middle Eastern countries to find a way to bring this to a halt. And I don't know how that's going to play out, but I have no reason to believe right now the United States can play a role in this, because they seem to be completely aligned with the extreme side of Israeli politics right now. And I'm happy to see that at least what we're seeing in some news media outlets, that there seems to be an uprising within Israel from those that are beginning to say, you know, enough of this, and they're starting to call what's happening genocide. And I know that's a term that is openly debated, but it's horrible that we as a human race can allow this to continue to happen, and it's time to bring a stop to it.
Libby Post.
Well, when you take a bird's eye view of all of this, to me, it's exemplary of what happens when right-wing, fervent religious factions take over governments. I think Terry alluded to it, of what's going on here in our country. We see it in Israel. We see it in Afghanistan. We've seen it in other countries. And it never ends well. I mean, that's, you know, the Crusades was all about that back in the day. And, I've said this before, that what Israel is doing is not, from my perspective as a Jew, what we're all about as a people. Our mission is to heal the world, tikkun olam. Our mission is to take care of those who are in need. You know, our mission is to not destroy a people. And, you know, even when over time we have seen many, many different countries want to destroy Israel and the Jewish community, that's not what we are about, and at least not where I come from in the Jewish community. The Reform Movement just put out a major statement. The conservative movement in Israel, it's called the Masorti Movement, has made it clear, as Jim said, there are people in Israel who are taking to the streets. They want this to stop. It's like, not in our name, please, right? And that's what's going to happen. What Israel is doing, ultimately, is making the world less safe for Jews all over the world, because we've seen this endemic rise of anti-Semitism since October 7th. So we really need to, Israel needs to do the right thing. And I know that's easy for me to say, but they need to stop. They need, you know, what the images that were in the articles that we read this morning will be used against Israel for centuries to come as a group of, as a country that does not care. And the thing is that I know that there are plenty of people within Israel who do care, but this government does not. And again, this government, our government, both of these guys, maintaining their power to stay out of jail. I mean, we know that that's part of the deal here.
Jim?
Yeah, just one additional thing to say, following on what Libby said, is because I hear it raised quite often, number one, you know, to say, well, Gazans, they elected Hamas, and basically, I mean, we've even seen Israeli politicians say all Gazans are guilty of what happened on October 7th. Collective punishment is a war crime, and that's clear. Secondly, to even intimate, much less say out loud, that the entirety or a vast amount of the population will be made to suffer so greatly that they will be removed from the territory. This mass relocation of people is also a crime against humanity. And this is not just me saying it or me kind of interpreting it. This is very clear. And so for any Israeli politician like Ben-Gvir to say this out loud and for that not to be renounced by our own government is profoundly, profoundly problematic.
Ahmad?
Yeah, so when looking at this, I struggle to see which version of the Israeli government would want better for the Palestinians across the territories, because this has, what we're seeing here throughout its history has either been on the scale of ethnic cleansing, has either been on the scale of an incremental genocide, as Ilan Pappe said back in 2006, through 2016, when there were multiple bombing campaigns on the people of Gaza. And then this is by far the worst episode that the Palestinians have seen in the last century of war against them. And we've seen it in both sides. You know, there's this narrative that Israel unilaterally pulled out of Gaza in 2005, 2006 and dismantled settlements. And there are people crying and this and that. And Gaza elected who they elected and so forth. And they used all the money to do X, Y, and Z. Well, I have to ask you a question. If you are locked in a basement and you are given $200 million, what good is that $200 million? What good is that $200 billion going to do you? What good is that $1 trillion going to do you if you are locked in a basement? And what are you going to do with that? You're going to try to dig yourself out. You're going to try to get out. And the Palestinians are crying to get out one way or another. And this has been a brutal occupation. And there's never been a brutal occupation without resistance against that occupation. And some of that resistance turns very ugly, unfortunately. But we should never be disillusioned in thinking that the root cause of that violence is somehow less preposterous than what the occupied lashes out with. The struggles of the oppressed, the violence of the oppressed is a call for desperation. The structure that precipitates that violence is the main culprit. And that's what really needs to be changed. And I'm encouraged by the younger Jewish voices who completely dissociate themselves and look forward to a Judaism post-Zionism or an altered definition of Zionism, one that does not predicate itself on all of historic Palestine and doesn't see the people who've been living there, who perhaps look more like Moses and Jesus than those who emigrated from Europe, as being these subhuman people who have no business being there. And I'm encouraged by the younger evangelical Christian population that dissociates itself from what people think is God's work, which can only be described as demonic in terms of not finding a war in the Middle East that they didn't fancy bombing or didn't fancy destroying a country. So these are just some other thoughts.
Jim?
You know, I think that the what none of us are able to kind of, you know, gather up is to see, well, what is the political horizon? So, you know, Ahmed was talking about younger people from various walks of life who perhaps have give a glimmer of hope in a way forward. But what kinds of policy steps can be taken that are within the realm of the possible that would be different than what's happening now? What has become of the long-standing two-state solution? What would a one-state solution look like? What is a way forward, and what are the steps toward that way forward that would be helpful and would be an alternative to this? It certainly is the case that there are people who are speaking out about what's happening. What is much harder to do is to come up with some really kind of specific, incremental, doable steps.
Terry, would you like to add anything before we take a news break?
No, I think that it's a great time for a news break.
We do have letters sent to panel at WAMC.org. We will share and discuss some of those after we hear a regional newscast from Ray Graff. The panel this morning, Ahmad Abu Hakma, Jim Ketterer, Libby Post, and Terry Gibson. Again, the email address, panel@WAMC.org. Please keep your letters short, to the point, and on topic. Don't send links or attachments. It's too cumbersome to navigate them while live on the radio. And don't use obscure abbreviations. And if you have a sec, do proofread your email before you hit send. Thanks so much. panel@WAMC.org, and we will be back after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue, in studio this morning with biomedical engineer and principal scientist at Regeneron, Ahmad Abu Hakma, senior fellow at Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, political consultant and lobbyist, Libby Post, and via phone, preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson. I said before we went to the regional newscast that we would be discussing emails sent by WAMC listeners to panel@WAMC.org, and I meant it. That's what we're doing now. Carrie writes in and says, "Call me naive, but aren't there Israelis on the left who think this starvation is horrible? Why aren't they protesting in the streets, or are they in the dark about it?" That's from Carrie. Would anybody like to address the question? Or speculate on the question, converse about it.
Say the question again.
Sure. Call me naive, but aren't there Israelis on the left who think this starvation is horrible? Why aren't they protesting in the streets, or do they not know about it?
Oh, there are people in Israel who know about it, and they are protesting. I mean, I don't think that there's any question about that. I mean, at the beginning of this, after October 7th, I reached out to a friend from high school who lives there now, and you know, everybody was on Israel's side. That's not the way it is anymore because of what has happened in our name. And there are many people who don't want this to continue. We have to remember that prior to October 7th, Netanyahu was focused on destroying the Supreme Court in Israel and taking away the majority of their powers, because the Supreme Court, unlike here, was a bulwark against some of the more right-wing policies that the Israeli government was trying to pass. And they were asleep at the wheel. And so, you know, he was more concerned with that. So there was, and we have to remember, there was plenty of demonstrations in the streets about that. Now there are demonstrations in the streets about this, and I do not think that the rank-and-file Israeli, who may or may not be religious, because many of them are not, is in agreement with starving a group of people, because it's not, as I said before, that's not who we are. I just want to say one thing, and that's, you know, made a comment before about, you know, you Palestinians, people of Arab descent, look more like Jesus did than the Eastern Europeans that emigrated there. We didn't emigrate. We were forced. We had no place else to go. There were ships of us after the war, and there was a deal cut, like Trump cuts his deals now. There was a deal cut, and yes, was it unfair to the people living in Israel then? Yes, it was, but we had no place to go. Unless you were in America, you had no place to go in Eastern Europe, in Western Europe, and we were, you know, the people that were in the camps were either able to come here because they had family, or they had to go someplace because they couldn't go back home because their homes were destroyed.
Absolutely. And there's nothing wrong with having a safe place to live, which is what everybody mm-hmm. wants. There's no problem with the Jews coming to, you know, Palestine post-World War II and after the concentration camps, which is just of the worst horrors and unfortunately the culmination of centuries-long mm-hmm. anti-Semitism in Europe. It's just the worst manifestation of it. The problem is how they came. They came with the intention to establish that land and, in the words of their founding fathers, to make it as Jewish as Britain is English or as France is French, with complete disregard for the local inhabitants. And their historical records prove that before our own historical records. That's my main contention with that. Of course, no one in Israeli society would tolerate starving humans, but you have to view them as humans first. There's a concerted effort to make sure that those people in Palestine and in Gaza are not humans, so that you can do with them as you wish. You see, prior to October 7th, over 90% of the water in Gaza is not potable. You know, the children in Gaza are shrinking prior to October 7th. They're missing their growth milestones because of malnutrition, which is turned on and off by a faucet by their occupier. And that was par for the course. That's not news. That's not news in the U.S. That's not news in Israel. That's just simply life, okay? And so once you peel back the propaganda that these are animals, once you peel back the propaganda and you're forced to look at, outside of the legacy media, but in social media perhaps, what's happening, then you have that huge friction and moral conflict in your heart, and you have people come out and say things. But it is after going against so much inertia that is telling you, animals that deserve to die, that don't deserve to eat, this, and that. And there's just so much force against something that is so clear and blatantly flagrant.
I also want to say that there is this generally accepted narrative that all the residents of Gaza somehow have, over the years, been highly supportive of Hamas. And that is simply not borne out by the experience, and it's also not borne out by a very reliable annual poll called the Arab Barometer, which was released, just so happens, on October 6th, 2023. And it showed very clearly that Palestinians living in Gaza were also deeply, deeply unhappy with the governance that was being carried out by Hamas. And so even if they did support Hamas, that doesn't necessarily mean that they were overall supporting what happened on October 7th. And none of this justifies a collective punishment against an entire population. None of it.
Terry Gibson?
I guess I'm just always reminded when we begin to have these discussions that I'm a citizen of a country who has a history that is not one that makes it easy for us to be proud of how we've handled situations like this in the past. You know, we were really, really late to coming in to deal with the genocide of the Jews during World War II and liberating the concentration camps. We did it. We came in, but it took us a long time to come around to that. And so many people lost their lives, their entire families, because of how long it took us. Mm-hmm. Of course, here on our own, what we now call our land, was a whole civilization of indigenous people that we subjected to genocide. And don't even, you know, if you want to really get into it, get on the path of slavery. So it is important to remember that we have an opportunity here to try to take the lead and show that we have learned from our mistakes and that we are a compassionate people and that we don't want to repeat the mistakes we've made here or any place else around the world. Yet, at least here in the United States, the leadership that is currently in charge is unwilling, uninterested in doing that. And so it's disappointing. And I hope that there is a leader out there somewhere that will speak up and have the power to help bring a stop to this.
Well, we have a leader in this country who doesn't care if people die. I mean, it's just that simple. You know, he doesn't care if Palestinians die. He doesn't really care if Israelis die. He doesn't care if children in his own country are dying of measles because of the idiocy and incompetence that is now sitting in HHS. He doesn't care if people are going to die because of climate change and everything, and we're going to have this influx of climate refugees eventually in the Northeast, because despite the fact that it's been 90 degrees a lot here, you know, in Albany and West, we're not going to be overtaken by the Hudson River anytime soon or the Atlantic. And so I think you're going to see people coming up. So this is a president who doesn't care about any of this. All he cares about is himself. And I'm afraid that we have the same type of presidency that's going on in Israel. And that's not good for anybody. I'll leave it at that.
Mike writes in to panel at WAMC.org and says, the political horizon for Israel and Palestine has to shift away from a two-state solution. A two-state solution is not viable, and maybe it never was. A single state with equal rights for everyone, that's the new political horizon. Single state, equal rights, and that is according to Mike in Albany.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, when I go visit my family in Palestine, in the West Bank, as well as Jerusalem, I see the impact of the quote-unquote two-state solution. I mean, it is... You know, an apartheid system, there's different law systems. I mean, if I want to access my grandfather's farmland, I have to understand that is on the other side of an Israeli bypass road that only Israeli citizens or me as an American citizen can go on. And I ask, when I go in 2004 versus going in 2009, Grandpa, why can't we go see those olive trees? Oh, because they're on the other side of a road that is now constructed and only for settlers, and I would get shot if I go on that road. And that is deliberate. If you look at Palestinian society, it is largely agrarian society. And you have these areas in the West Bank, for example, that are carved up into areas A, B, and C. Areas, one of them, for example, the villages have where the people are living and the farmland. And those designations are different. Where the people are living, Palestinians in many places have some sort of self-rule. But their farmland... they have no control over it. We need a permit to go harvest our olive trees every single year. And that is our cash crop, right? That is my salary. It comes in November, December. I harvest October. I press November. I distribute December and I get paid December, January. I have to hold my breath if I'm going to access that while we're getting year-end bonuses here in the United States. You know, and that is a system of... if you want to burn down an olive tree, no one's going to stop you as an Israeli settler. If you're going to uproot olive trees, if you're going to draw, if you're going to build a road and destroy houses and expand settlements, you can literally look at a map over Palestine and see areas that are more green and less green simply because there's a settlement here and a village here. And that's because of the occupation of water. The population is about split down the middle between Palestinians and Jews in the area. But the Jews have 98% of the water in the area in a report that is published, the occupation of water. And I'll just stop at that.
Jim?
Well, I mean, the letter writer says we should get, you know, to a one-state solution. And so, as I said before the break, so how do we get there? What are the steps to... slowly, slowly, because it's not going to happen with a flip of a switch, start to move in that direction. I mean, we started off talking about the current humanitarian crisis in Gaza. So, you know, that needs to be stopped immediately. That's not going to be the kind of thing that where people can survive to take the time to address this longer term political horizon issue. But you know, it has turned out to be absolutely impossible to think about the kind of the end result and the grand goal that should be reached and then not deal with the details. And so I say there has to be people not only of goodwill, but people who understand that there's the common interest in doing so to say, let us sort out a way forward that is detailed, that is doable, and that is in the interest of everyone involved. Otherwise, it's just simply not going to happen. I mean, Ahmed was talking about the West Bank. The situation in the West Bank prior to October 7th was also very superheated. I mean, there's been settlers and an increase in settlers for quite some time, but it was really increasing over those months preceding October 7th. And I thought that's where we were going to see a conflagration. It has not abated, however. With all the attention on Gaza, There's been less attention, at least here in the U.S., on what's happening in the West Bank, and that is also highly problematic, to put it mildly.
Paul emails panel@wamc.org and says, given that the U.S. is not an unbiased or honest broker in the Palestinian conflict, what countries can serve that role, and what are the impediments for them doing that? What role can the wealthy Gulf states take? That's from Paul.
Well, I think the wealthy Gulf states could take a role if they really wanted to. I also think that there are countries in Europe that could play a role in this. Right now, I wouldn't ask or suggest that the United States be involved in any kind of negotiation around a settlement with this, you know, to try to create a new government, to try to create a new way of being in Israel. But I think that there are other countries, but they have to also be willing to put in the time and the resources and recognize that it's going to be up, down, up, down, up, down for a very, very long time until everyone can come to an agreement. And it's not going to be an easy agreement to make.
Go ahead, Jen.
I was just going to say the French recently announced that they mm-hmm. were going to enact an official recognition of a Palestinian state. Well, that's all well and good, but what does it really translate into? What does it translate into in terms of changing the situation on the ground? And I think the Saudis and the French are working together now on the latest talks. I go back again, what the devil's in the details. Without kind of a specific, concrete plan forward, just saying we now recognize a Palestinian state doesn't really do anything.
Oh, it helps him with his left flank.
I mean, politically,
that's
perhaps,
what it does.
But I'm not saying that I'm just not aware that the French specifically have any kind of detailed plan to follow up this announcement.
Ahmad?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, saying that is obviously, it's a nice soundbite, but like you said, you know, you want to see what that actually translates to in terms of action. But even that soundbite is somehow problematic for our elected officials, saying you are rewarding terror by recognizing Palestine, which I think is deeply problematic. With regards to the Gulf states, yes, they have a lot of money. At the same time, many of them are trying to strike deals with the United States where they are kind of held at the neck, and they want to walk a particular line so that they get what they want, basically. And that's profoundly different to what we were just talking about, Jim, before the show, about the will of the people of many of these countries, whether it is, you know, those Middle East, North African nations or the Gulf nations. You know, Palestine is in the heart of every single, I would say, Muslim in the world, not just in those countries, but also, you know, the Southeast Asian countries and here. And so it's something that is profoundly, deeply attached to our hearts for, and we recognize its importance to all of the major faiths, from Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So I would just say working towards reflecting the will of the people and not criminalizing dissent in those countries, which is the status quo, unfortunately.
We have an email from Dan sorry, go ahead, Terry.
Well, I was just going to follow up, I think, what Ahmad said about some of these countries who potentially do have the leadership to play a role in bringing an end to this crisis, this war, this conflict, are to some degree also watching very closely the United States and specifically Donald Trump, because they need things from the United States, and they know that if they take a visible, vocal lead in this conflict, that it will draw Trump into it somehow, and it may not work out to their benefit on the bigger things that they want. And the thing that I keep thinking and keep watching is that even though Donald Trump is not capable, nor is his administration capable, or really, I think, even interested in bringing an end to this awful situation, when someone does step forward to try to do that, you can guarantee that you will be hearing almost immediately from Donald Trump, because he does have the largest microphone. And one thing we see over and over again is he doesn't like anyone to take it away from him. Mm-hmm. And so whoever steps forward to try to resolve this Donald Trump is going to find a way to get involved in it so that he can ultimately come out looking like the guy that solved the problem and take credit for it, which is what he always does. He lets someone else do the dirty work, and he comes in and takes credit for it, having done really nothing. So I'm going to be watching that interesting sort of relationship play out.
It's that hero syndrome that I talked about before. Plays out in everything that he does.
We have an email from Dan, panel at WAMC.org, says, why does Hamas not offer to return all the remaining hostages? Wouldn't that lead to peace? That's a question for discussion.
I don't think it would lead to peace. I don't think it would even remotely lead to any type of peace. I think what is being pushed by the extreme right faction in Israel is really has nothing to do with these hostages, which is made this whole the messaging on this whole campaign even just more awful, because they continue to use the hostages as an excuse. Of course, you want the hostages back, but I don't see that it brings peace to this conflict. Maybe someone else there has a different perspective than me.
No, I agree. I mean, in general, if you just hear Trump, when he walked away from this last deal, he said, oh, they knew if we get the last hostages that we're coming after them now, mm-hmm. Type of thing. So that's one thing. But also we have to keep in mind that the Palestinians are hostage as well. They are hostage to a brutal occupation. That's one. Two, if we want to substantiate the entire scenario, it's return the hostages, lay down your arms and leave is what they've presented. Well, the Palestinians have done this. Has done something similar like this in 1982 when they were in Lebanon, and they were told if the PLO lays down their arms and leaves, we will protect all the people in the refugee camps. And you know when Sabra and Shatila happened? It happened after they left. They left, and then Ariel Sharon and Rabin and all those leaders who ended up being presidents and orchestrated one of the worst massacres, which Ronald Reagan called and said, stop the Holocaust in Beirut. You know, that was all after the Palestinians did exactly what they were told to do, and they would be promised everything. Just like they're told, go to these safe zones, only to be bombed at those safe zones. So there is a clear agenda, and unfortunately, returning the hostages is not going to change anything for the Palestinians, as much as we want to see everyone reunited with their families and freed.
Another email from Russell, who says, the subject line is American support for Israel. It says, excuse me. Mr. Gibson seems to think, as does Ms. Post, that this is somehow a partisan issue. I would propose that these panelists that the Biden administration was no friend to the Palestinian people, nor to peace and justice. And it sickens me to have to pay for this, as it should anyone who cares about human life. Libby, you don't agree with the accusation. I can tell from your face.
I didn't say it was partisan. I just tried to point out what was done before versus what's being done now. That's it.
Terry?
Well, it's impossible to know what the Biden administration would do if they were in this position now. Things have changed dramatically since Donald Trump took office, so you can't really predict that. I certainly wasn't happy with the position that Biden and his administration took with Israel in the time that they were trying to manage the crisis. I don't think they did anything to help resolve it. I think that's pretty clear. But we can only look to who's in charge now, and that is where I point the blame at the moment, because they have the power, the resources, to play a leadership role in this and bring it to an end, and they're refusing to do that and allowing that suffering to continue.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org. We are a couple of minutes away from our next news break, but I think we'll transition to discussing Cambodia and Thailand, if that's all right with everyone in the room. Great. Thank you for your thoughtful letters and conversation about the horrible situation in Gaza. Now moving on to another very fraught situation. Cambodia and Thailand did agree to a ceasefire this morning, set to start at midnight local time after attending talks in Malaysia aimed at ending a five-day border dispute that has left dozens dead. The ceasefire came after U.S. President Donald Trump threatened both countries with higher tariffs if the fighting continued, and amid pressure from China and the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. However, even as the talks in Kuala Lumpur were underway, fighting was reported to be ongoing. Cambodia and Thailand have long had a dispute over part of their shared border, which has resulted in sporadic eruptions of fighting from time to time, most recently before now in 2011. You can join the conversation by emailing us panel@wamc.org. Jim, would you like to make your comments about this conflict and potential ceasefire before we go to break?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of layers to this that, like with any of these kind of conflicts, there are bits and pieces of it longstanding. The contested border, not surprisingly, goes back to a colonial map, a French colonial map, 1907, that is interpreted now differently by both sides in this conflict. But if we go back and look at a variety of border conflicts in certain parts of the world, we see that this map drawing by colonial powers created all kinds of problems. Now, that having been said, you know, there is no such thing as a natural border versus an artificial border. When I talk with my students about the nature of borders, they're all artificial to a certain extent. But why do some hold and some become contested? You know, we can also look to not only the contestation of the border over a long time between these two countries, but also the politics within and between the two countries. And over the past few months, it's gotten hot and heavy between these two. A leaked phone call, political instability on the Thai side. On the Cambodian side, all kinds of competition between the United States and China as outside forces, and it looks like the U.S. is losing that struggle in terms of influence. There's lots of bits and pieces, and the last thing I would say is that I heard a radio report where someone was commentating and saying, well, you know, the stakes are really too high for them to really go to war with each other. Any two countries or multiple countries that have gone to war with each other, the stakes have always been too high, and yet war has still happened. And so I think that's a kind of a very rosy, optimistic view of why war wouldn't happen, and it's a misreading of history of why war does happen. And this is a very dangerous situation.
We'll continue the conversation on this topic after a world news update from the BBC. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. The panel this morning, Ahmad Abu Hakma, Jim Ketterer, Libby Post, and Terry Gibson. We paused for break discussing the current conflict and hopefully agreed to and lasting ceasefire that was agreed upon between Cambodia and Thailand this morning. Jim Ketterer spoke before the break. Terry Gibson?
I guess I'd like to see some evidence that Trump threatening a 50% tariff on these countries had really anything to do with this agreement that they have made for ceasefire. The issue, as Jim laid out, is so complex and goes back so far in history and involves so many different players. This is hard for me to believe that simply going out there and threatening this tariff could just bring it all to a stop. It doesn't make any sense. And I think it's just another case of the legacy media here in this country is buying into the talking points that come out of D.C. and giving this administration way too much credit for somehow having the know-how to bring these types of conflicts to an end. You can see that maybe within weeks, months, certainly years, this conflict will probably continue. It's not over. I'm just seems certain of that.
Ahmad?
Yeah, I just wanted to underline Jim's point about, you know, this is just the rotting corpse of colonial maps rearing its ugly head again. That's number one. But two, I welcome the ceasefire news and I hope it really holds, because I'm sorry, my throat, this is just lingering from a cold 3 weeks ago.
Sure. These colds, they stick around now. There's a rasp forever, it feels like.
Just to put into numbers, you know, you know, this is over 200,000 people that have been displaced on both sides of the border. That's twice the county. That's twice Albany's population, pretty much. And so these are not just people. These are people with houses, agrarian culture, agrarian society, farms that need to be tended to, animals. That's them returning. What do they return to? That's another thing. So we hope that there's some norm there. And the one thing that sticks out to me is how amazing it is that our politicians can find potentially the right words to say when it's a conflict that we are not complicit in. And I'm reminded of how they apply pressure on both sides to have a ceasefire. And I'm reminded of Biden's words when Russia invaded Ukraine, where he says, who in the Lord's name gave Putin, you know, the right to claim so-called countries that belong to their neighbor? And I wish that they could have this sort of rhetoric when it comes to Palestine.
Jim?
The number of displaced people, I think, you know, that gives it some reality. So like, what happens with these border conflicts? And also, you know, this border that is contested runs down the middle of people who share a lot on both sides of this border. And we see other parts of the world, for instance, the Kurds in the Middle East, who the borders that have been put in place have divided them up amongst four countries. And so same with the Khmer people here who have been divided up, I think also among four countries, and certainly on both sides of this border.
Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. We'll, of course, as always, continue to keep an eye on every story, every conflict around the world, and we will fit in one more topic this morning. More than 140 employees of the National Science Foundation have signed a letter denouncing what they described as efforts to undermine one of the country's main science funding agencies. This coverage, kind of a blend from the New York Times and NPR. They accuse the Trump administration of abruptly firing workers, withholding funds, and decimating the agency's budget. The National Science Foundation declined to comment on the letter. The formal protest by the employees followed similar ones made last month by workers from the National Institute of Health and Environmental Protection Agency, who criticized orders that they saw as unlawful and accused the administration of endangering public health. The EPA suspended 144 of the signatories a few days after the letter was sent, a step that has been described by some as retaliation. Further, hundreds of NASA employees have issued their own letter of formal dissent last week, addressing the Secretary of Transportation, Sean Duffy. The letter warned the agency's leadership that major budget cuts would harm science missions. Libby.
I feel like we're in the Middle Ages, that it's medieval kind of politics here. That because during the Middle Ages and the medieval times, you know, they shunned the scientists, they shunned the forward thinkers, they shunned all of those folks who we now or had, at least when I was growing up, heralded, like, you know, Michelangelo and all the rest of those folks. You know, and you know, this is an administration that I don't know if they believe in science or not. I don't think they know what they believe and don't believe. Right. Right. Sarah's absolutely right. She just did the money sign. It's all about money. Now, if Trump owned a medical research company or a medical device company or some other pharmaceutical company or maybe a spaceship company that's going to go to the moon, none of this would have happened because it would have lined his pockets ultimately. And that's all this is the biggest grift that we've ever experience in this country, and this is Donald Trump. He is once again putting people's lives at risk. Trials have been canceled. Cancer trials have been canceled. Cancer research has been canceled. Other kinds of life-saving research has been canceled. And to what end? So that poor people, people of color, people who suffer from health disparities are going to die. They'll die sooner, and they don't care. Even though a lot of those people are in the red states, they still don't care because, oh, well, we'll, you know, just keep going what we're doing because we have to give major tax breaks to the rich people so that this country can continue. I mean, it's disgusting. It is just absolutely disgusting.
Terry Gibson.
Well, I agree. It is disgusting.
I thought you might. Thanks, Terry.
I mean, how are you gonna? It's you know, what we're seeing over and over again, and this letter is just a continuation of these brave, dedicated public servants that are trying over and over again with all of the tools and the power they have to tell us, the average American citizen, that, hey, listen to us. We are in the inside where these things are happening, and we are telling you that there is an administration that is doing everything they can to take away all the power that we have normally had, to take away all the resources we normally had, and is doing real damage to our ability to provide good, sound scientific advice, to do good, sound scientific research, to be a leader in new scientific discoveries. And we are in big trouble if we allow this to happen. And it's happening in the scientific community. It's happening in the justice community. It's happening in every community you can think of where there might be a government agency overseeing it, the environmental community. And these warning signs just keep coming and coming and coming. And how much longer can we withstand it before it's just too late? And we literally do have an authoritarian government that pretty much decides everything from one person. And it seems like we're just getting closer every day. And I mean, the names of this letter, as I understand it, were redacted except for one, mm-hmm. because they feel compelled to protect themselves.
He's the president of the union. So if there's anybody right. who's going to step up, it would be the president of the union, and he is protecting his workers.
And Jim. So we are now at that point where American citizens are fearful of speaking out because they will lose their job and possibly have their lives threatened by those who support this administration and feel compelled to play a role in this retribution of anyone who should speak out against anything that he does, regardless of how absolutely devastating it will be to this country.
Jim?
You know, during the Cold War, we created an infrastructure and we created institutions that basically won the Cold War. This scientific infrastructure and the relationship between that infrastructure and our great research universities was this magnetizing force that attracted the best talent from around the world and trained the best talent here of Americans and really created outcomes that have been so beneficial to so many people in the United States and worldwide. So to tear down these institutions where there's no evidence of any kind of graft and fraud and all of the things that are being accused, or that they're too woke or anything like that, to tear down these institutions, to defund them, to take the research money, or to at least threaten to take the research money away from our great research universities, what is the vision that is being implemented here? What is the end goal that is not only driving our leadership to do this, but is driving so many Americans to support this, because the end result is going to be awful. I have lived in places where there is the training of great medical and scientific professionals, but the infrastructure and the institutions simply aren't there to support them. Many of those who are trained leave for their own career reasons and because they've wanted to come to places where they can carry out science. I can tell you that the health results, the science results, the educational results in those places is greatly diminished. Is that really what people want?
We have about a minute left. Ahmad, if you'd like to add your comments, please.
Yeah, I would just think that, you know, somebody like Donald Trump, who was potentially on his deathbed, if not for a medicine that we made at Regeneron, saved his life.
Are you sure about that?
Well, he called it a miracle drug, too.
I thought he did it.
Oh, yeah, he might have made it. Yeah. And then he went to the...
It was a crisis he created, COVID.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, I would just think that it would espouse some humility and some deference to the scientific process. It's not perfect, but it is a self-correcting process where we're doing the best that we can. And when we know better, we do better. And cutting off funding to grants that fund research not only prevents scientific advances, but it halts careers and puts people under, you know, extreme stress. So I'll just conclude with that.
Thank you. Our panel this morning, Ahmad Abu-Hakma, Jim Ketterer, Libby Post, and Terry Gibson. We are out of time for this morning. The Congressional Corner is next. Thank you all for being here.